Greetings and welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie. My name is Jason.
And I'm Rich.
And I'm Chris.
And we've only gone and made it to the 50th episode.
Hey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah. Woo! Come on.
doesn't seem right.
You heard that right. Our 50th episode. Who'd have thought it? We would make it this far. But not only have we made it to this grand achievement, but we're also celebrating our 2-year anniversary of our first episode going live on the 8th of November, 2020. We have a couple of ways. Yes, another yay. Love it.
Yay.
We have a couple of ways.
Here to be the audience, Sanya.
she can do as many yays as she likes. It's fine. We have a couple of ways in which we are celebrating these major feats in our podcasting career. And the first is a Twitter competition, which will be going live the same day this episode drops. And it will give you the chance to win a one-of-a-kind framed Jurassic Park VHS. Yes, let's hear some woos.
Hey.
So head over to our Twitter page and find out how you can join in on that. And the second way we are celebrating is this very episode you are listening to right now. I'm very excited to say that we have two guests joining us to help celebrate our feats. And the first is returning to the show, hopefully with Abinus, is Digitizer's very own Mr. Biffo.
You see, now you made me want to do the entire thing as Beanus.
That would be an
honor. Stunning.
And I just want to ask you, Biffo, is like, how's Monty?
What?
I wondered if he was going to remember this reference.
What? Oh, hang on. This rings a bell now. Remind me.
It was in one of your videos, I think, last month. Of course. Which one was it? I think it was the one where you're going through the yearbook.
Oh, Monty. Yes. Yeah. Oh, God. That had, people really picked up on that. Monty. Yeah.
Get down from there, Monty.
Yeah. Geez, yeah. I mean, that was just like a completely off the cuff moment. And then it's weird that things, it's like Venus wasn't meant to take off. It was meant to be a terrible character. It was meant to be a kind of one-off joke. And then people took him to their hearts. And then likewise, that Monty thing, we sort of said we should bring back Monty's mum. Because it's like, people, funny. It was just a response to, you know, terrible reviews of, I can't remember which one particularly was it, which it was, Madame Tussauds or something like that. Bad reviews of British tourist attractions.
Oh, that was it. Yeah. TripAdvisor reviews. Our reviews.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
There's astonishing indignation on there by people. And I just imagined Monty's mother.
in the meantime at the park.
Yes. I'm sure that was the episode, wasn't it? See, now I'm down, starting down myself. We don't know.
Great memory.
I think it was, yeah. In summary, really, it's just a big clock. You know, it's just.
It's just a big clock there, really.
Shit.
Not even the clock, is it? It's a big bell.
Big bell, yeah.
And everyone on TripAdvisor will tell you.
Yeah. That was unbelievable, really, some of those. That's just crazy.
It was a gold mine. I don't know what made me look them up in the first place, but I started looking as well to do a follow up, but looking for sort of bad tradesmen reviews of like sort of plumbers and people like that. But they were all the same. They all kind of complained about it being too expensive. There were no funny ones. Didn't do the work properly. And
restaurant reviews is good too.
Yeah, we should have a look for those. Mm. Look at this. We're pitching. We're live on your podcast.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad Monty's all right now you've remembered him. So
yes, he's fine. He's gone to bed. Monty's awesome. In bed now.
Brilliant. And as you just heard there as well, our second guest is frankly the star of the show, the YouTube sensation that is Sanya Rose.
Yay.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Another debut, guest appears.
Welcome.
Oh, it's so exciting.
It is really exciting to have you here and to be able to chat interactively with you instead of just seeing you on a video on YouTube. So, yeah, thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Oh, my pleasure.
I mean, it's not like we had to do a lot of arranging. I mean, she literally lives in the same house. you think Sanya would come on? But probably, I reckon I could wrangle that.
And I tell you what, one of the things that I really love about seeing you in the digitizer videos is just some of the looks that you give Paul sometimes. When he's doing some of his ablibbing. Is that a good way of saying it?
I guess. That's what you want to call it. Yeah.
And I look over to you, Senya, and then just see the some of the looks that you have on your face directed at Paul, and it's just it's some of the best parts of the video sometimes.
Thing is, yeah, it's it wouldn't work unless there was someone reacting there. I mean, the one we did recently for Halloween with Beanus, Halloween.
Oh my goodness! What, in the sweet shop?
Yeah.
Oh, I was genuinely distressed.
Yeah,
I've never laughed so much at Butcher's knife. I was tearing up.
He didn't tell. He didn't tell me he was going to bring a real knife.
So hasn't seen the episode. I mean, actually, it isn't any better if you've seen the episode. We filmed an episode in a supposedly haunted sweet shop, and I thought it would be funny to bring a real knife and surprise everyone.
Funny. And then I kept trying to figure out if it was real or fake because he was like waving it around really quickly, which again, not great for my nerves. But when you were tapping it on thing, it was on things, it was tinging, and it was like, it's actually a real knife, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
it's a real knife.
That
I knew what reaction you would have. This is the thing, you know, I can often do things because I know how Sanya will react.
I was genuinely nervous. Do you know how clumsy Paul is? It's like in the last month, he's cut his hand twice chopping onions or vegetables.
Or chicken, yeah.
So it's like, really, do you want to bring a real knife along to this thing?
Wouldn't have been funny if it's a fake one.
Exactly.
I'm glad you cleared that up because I was going to ask whether you was actually pretending that it was a real knife and you was all just, you know, acting that way towards Venus, or was the fact that it was actually a real knife. And if it wasn't actual real knife, like you say it was, then you was licking that knife, man. I was squirming.
Yeah.
Again, because I know what will freak Sanya out.
Yeah.
It was a spur of the moment thing because we'd had a bit of a week, and I knew we were doing this shoot in a sweet shop, and normally with Venus, the thing for me is to tell people as little as possible so that they don't know what's going to happen. It's like we did a Christmas one last year where in the middle of it, Beanus starts handing out these pills saying we should all take our vaccine. And it's, for me, it's one of my favourite things we've ever done because Dan, who was with us, and Ryan, who were two of the guests in this Beanus game show, were like legitimately freaked out that Beanus was encouraging them to take these pills.
Especially Dan. Anatomical board. No, Dan, he's Dan does now.
Yeah, who was actually in the...
It was his sweet shop, yeah.
But yeah, and it's the look on their faces of like genuine, like, shit, yeah. Do I do this? What is in these? But it was so, but I hadn't had anything for the Halloween thing.
Can we just clear up? They weren't actual pills. They were just
empty cases.
That one wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't give anything worry. With the Halloween one, I didn't have anything. And it was just literally as we were walking out the door to drive to Kent, that I just thought, Beanus should have a knife. Oh, just grabbed it in my bag. I mean, if we'd been stopped by the police, get his bag with a bean mask and a knife in it. Been screwed. So no one knew when, you know, even when I went and got into the costume, Beanus, I'm spoiling all the behind-the-scenes secrets. Beanus is a real person, yes. He takes over me. I hid it. I had to hide it when I went to get changed. Around my top so that no one would see until the moment being disappeared with this knife.
Again, super safe, hiding a knife down your top.
It is what it is.
The best line in that whole video was still just for me. Was it, don't try this at home, try this at Paul's home. And just does the stabbing motions. I was just in hysterics for that. So
this whole bit at the end, which is my favourite shot, where actually when we were filming it, it's Beanus is sat down and you've got Dan in one corner, you've got Eli sat behind the counter and Paul just standing there. No one knows what the hell to do because we've sort of basically run out of steam. But the fact is Beanus is sat there with a knife. So when you watch it back, it just looks like Beanus is holding them all hostage and no one dare move. And she stabs him. So kind of, it was unintentional because what actually was going on after we stopped filming those bits was everyone going, this is shit and it's not working. Anyway, don't play with knives, kids.
Okay, so what we're going to do in this episode is that Mr. Biffo and Senya have very kindly chosen some of their favourite movies, TV shows and games for us to discuss. We might as well just get straight into those right now. Mr. Biffo,
yes.
Would you please let the good audience know what film it was that you chose?
I deliberated for about 10 minutes, but I thought I've got to be honest and true to myself, so I went for... I thought, if I don't say Star Wars, I'm just not being honest. And it's not Star Wars the film, it's Empire Strikes Back, because it's my favourite of the Star Wars films. It just, you know, those films, they changed the course of my life without a shadow of a doubt. I know I'm not the only middle-aged man to be able to say that, but it was, you know, up until the age of, I don't know how old the time when Star Wars came out, I was probably six or seven when I first watched it. And it so blew my mind and unlocked a kind of imagination in me, or gave my imagination sort of permission to just run free in a weird sort of way. And as well, and this is kind of actually when we talk about TV shows, it's a similar thing there. Something that Star Wars as well, really early on, and The Empire Strikes Back, again, unlocked was just the fascination of how the hell do they do this? How is this possible, you know, to make this fake universe and make it feel so real and tangible? And because early on you had on TV shows that showed the making of. And that, for me, I loved as much as the films themselves, you know, and things like the attention to detail. I've got this weird thing with The Empire Strikes Back. This is going to sound really weird. There's a stain on the wall in The Empire Strikes Back, right? It's a brown stain, not what you think, as far as I know. But in one of the corridor scenes, there's just this stain on the wall. And I've always been fascinated with this sort of dripping brown stain, because someone had to make a conscious, creative choice to go, I'm going to put a brown stain there. But that sort of little attention to detail just makes it real and makes it tangible. And that for me is what, you know, Star Wars was, but then Empire Strikes Back just improved on that. And you just feel everything in that film is a struggle and it's hard. The spaceship doesn't work. You know, they haven't got heating in the base and just everything is hard and makes it feel so grounded and real. And for me, that's always been, when Star Wars gets it right, and it frequently doesn't, but when it gets it right, it feels tangible. And it feels, you know, that was the real true genius of George Lucas, was that lived in universe. And I think, you know, it's possibly telling that he was too close to it, that he needed to hand it over to other people like Irving Kirshner, who directed Empire Strikes Back, to absolutely perfect that and see perhaps what Lucas couldn't see because he was too burnt out from the first one. But, you know, he did start that. And it's just... And then also with Empire... Actually, I know this is something Sanya loves about it, is the mystical side of it. The Force in that film, in a way that has never been done since, feels strange and feels alien and feels truly sort of magical, in a way that no other Star Wars thing has ever really captured it for me. Yeah. In short, Empire Strikes Back, I can't tell you how much I love it. I mean, how much I love Star Wars or the Star Wars universe as a whole. You know, again, not every film, not every TV show, not every cartoon. But you know, Empire Strikes Back was where it solidified for me. I can remember coming back from seeing it the first time and building a Lego Bespin and reenacting the final scene with my action figures, just immediately straight away, because I wanted to relive it. You know, my mind was so blown. It's like, he can't be his dad. He just can't be his dad. Yeah. You know, best,
you know. You were best processing it through.
It was. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was what, 3 years before I spent 3 years in denial about the fact that Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's dad. Yeah, I was like, no, it must be. The Emperor must have told him to say that or something. So anyway, there we go.
You can recite all the words pretty much to the first three films.
Yes.
Can't you?
Yeah. So yeah, if I put it on, I will annoyingly quote along with it, but not along with it. I will try and quote along with it before the characters say the lines. It's so annoying.
No.
How annoying.
Well, I mean, Empire is the better. I think a lot of people say Star Wars, A New Hope is the quintessential Star Wars film. But I think so, yeah. I mean, from what I read anyway. But like, I get quite bored of watching that film these days because I've seen it so many times.
It's more pure, I suppose, of people, you know, there's a real innocence to A New Hope. But actually, you know, it was, I think, groundbreaking at the time in special effects and in all sorts of other ways, you know, and the characters are great and the universe is great. But it's a really weirdly structured film. If you actually, I know a lot of it was kind of reworked in the edit, but it's oddly structured. You know, you don't see the hero until the sort of beginning of the second act, really. You know, it's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination, you know. And also, I mean, you know, George Lucas has admitted it was like hugely compromised creatively from his point of view, you know, which is why I think Empire, for me, I have to pick that over A New Hope, because it's just perfect in terms of sort of structure and everything else and storytelling and characterization. So, but I still, you know, I still love the first one.
Like you were saying with Empire, and it just had so much more than A New Hope and Return to the Jedi, I guess, because it just couldn't beat that characterization, like you mentioned, with Luke and the journey that he goes on with me and Yoda, and then obviously finding out his dad at the end and things like that. But I mean, of course, the only other the great thing of the film is that Hoth battle sequence as well. It's just
It's just
can't be beaten.
Is the genius of it is putting the big action sequence at the beginning, and then the emotional whammy right at the end with the lightsaber fight is so clever and so unexpected in, you know, in loads of ways to do that. But, you know, and the action never has that scale again throughout the film. All right, that lightsaber fight at the end is brilliant and epic in its own way. But, you know, you haven't got big machines. It's all about the emotional stakes, which is why I got so annoyed with The Phantom Menace, as did a lot of people. Because that lightsaber fight at the end with Darth Maul, there's no emotional stakes whatsoever going on during that. And it's like, George, you know how to do this. Yeah. You know how to make this matter. And yet you've got, for a start, two guys beating up one guy. All right, he's got a double-bladed lightsaber and looks like the devil. Ooh. But, you know, there's nothing. I'm not invested in this. I don't care. Yeah. I don't care the fact. Yeah, the doors are open. You started to have a fight with him, but you haven't really explained what's at stake for any of the characters. And anyway, I won't rant about Phantom Menace now. Well, I could.
I think you're echoing all our feelings from The Phantom Menace, so it's fine.
I mean, similar to what Paul said, I think what I love about Empire, Star Wars is at its best, I think, when it feels just kind of lived in and grounded. And that's why I love Rogue One. That's why I love most recently Andor, because it's
so good.
Everyone's so good. Just downtrodden, struggling. It feels real and raw. And yeah, I get increasingly jaded now when it comes to all the Skywalker saga and the mysticism. I love the ground level stuff. I love just people going about their business day to day. It's just,
Andor has made me realize that was actually what I loved about Star Wars originally, was the fact it's about a kid and you see him having, you know, blue milk with his aunt and uncle and going about, you know, his work on the farm and like playing with, you know, toy spaceship and stuff. And Andor is like, you know, it's a guy sitting down having breakfast while his mum nags him.
Yeah.
And he's having cereal. And
he slurps just to drive around. I just love that.
It feels so believable.
It was an analogue to real life, present day real life, with that sci-fi veneer. Perfectly balanced to where the sci-fi veneer didn't overshadow the core storytelling.
Yeah.
That's absolutely it. It felt like you're sort of embedded in it, the storytelling. You could buy into the storytelling more because you bought into the universe. So on an emotional level, it invited you in because it was recognizable enough, I think, so you could relate more to that world.
It's like all the day-to-day details make the world more believable and relatable. You could be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true.
Grounded it was just like, I'm a big Star Trek fan. However, very sterile on board ships.
Yeah. It's always bothered me with Star Trek. I like Star Trek. I don't love it because it's the same reason. It was like, I loved the the 80s movies more, because they always felt there was a bit, I think, in Wrath of Khan where there's a guy polishing the floor while Kirk
it's silly stuff like that.
Yeah.
Normal day-to-day things, like on Wrath of Khan, for instance, in the simulator room, there's a no-smoking sign.
Yes.
And Gene Roddenberry hated that. He said, why is that there? This is a utopian future. The director turned around to him with a big cigar in his mouth, Nicholas Meyer, and was like, we've been smoking for thousands of years. Do you think we're going to stop in 200?
Yeah.
It's so true, because you see some no-smoking signs everywhere. And like Star Wars, you walk down the street, you see litter, you see broken air conditioning units, you see people lugging crap in out of a skip, you see tramps, you see people who don't have homes sitting there. You watch Star Wars, you see exactly the same.
The
opening scene of Andor was in a brothel. I mean, say no more. It's just like...
It's so accessible. I say this about many, many sitcoms and stuff like that as well, and TV shows. And Star Trek was the same until Deep Space Nine came along, where it had a lived-in station setting where nothing had its place. Everything was everywhere. You go to all your mates' houses. How many of your mates or friends or families' houses were perfect show homes?
Yeah. Yeah.
By having it a bit cluttered and a bit lived in and a bit grimy, everyone lives like that. Instantly relaxed cinema in that setting. Ready for that.
I start a tangent by bringing up Andor now, but
everyone needs to be watching it. I think even people who don't like Star Wars should be watching Andor, because you don't need to know anything. So, yeah.
Andor is worth a mention. I wasn't sure about it at first. I didn't like the first episode. I didn't like it or dislike it. I was just intrigued. But as it's gone on, it's like I've become more and more invested in it until it's reached the point where it's like, I can't wait until the next episode.
Just the tension just keeps ratcheting up.
Yeah.
Brilliant telly.
All right. Let's move on to Sanya's pick. Which film did you pick, Sanya?
Okay. I picked, this was really hard for me because it's like, I'm not like Paul. Like I'm not like a super fan of anything. And I'm not one of those people that can rewatch things. So I don't like, you know, my girls will rewatch Friends a million times or Gilmore Girls a million times. So I found it really hard to choose because I'll tend to just like watch a film and then move on to the next one. So nothing kind of sticks as a super favorite. But I had to pick Cinema Paradiso because this was like an outlier, even though I haven't watched it in like 20 years. So I don't know how it can still stay as favorite film. But when I was about, I think around 17 or 18, I watched this film literally every day for months. So I probably have seen it more than 10 times. I would watch it every day, and every time I would cry. Wow. And it's like, get a life. And my parents were like, oh my God, he's watching it again. So it has to be number one, even though I kind of like, I watched it so much that I haven't been able to watch it again for 20 years because it's like, I've worn it out. Although I did this week listen to the soundtrack again because that's phenomenal. I can listen to that. Ennio Morricone.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I can listen to the soundtrack on repeat forever. Yeah.
Any time that signature theme came in on the film, I never got bored of hearing it. Oh, it was just beautiful every time.
By Ennio Morricone, you almost forget the soundtrack's there, and that's why he's so legendary. Because it's in the background, it's complementing every scene visually, thematically, emotionally, and then all of a sudden something plays out, oh shit, Ennio Morricone. Yeah. And then it just filters away, and it's just gorgeous. It's just so gorgeous.
Yeah. Theme from The Mission is
I know. There's just something about his music that just hits me every time. I don't know what it is. He's just got like the magic musical touch that kind of like is on the same frequency as my personal musical taste is, I suppose. So yeah, absolutely love it. And I think that's there's two reasons why this film is considered one of my favorites, if not the favorite. Number one is probably the music, because the music is just phenomenal. But it was because it's set in a little village in Sicily, and it really reminded me of the town where my dad was born on Korčula, the island of Korčula in Croatia. He lived there until he was 15, and we'd go there every summer. So watching this film, we'd been living in Australia at that point for like, a long time, over 10 years. So it was kind of like it hit the heart kind of in that nostalgic place, as well as then that music just, oh my God, it was so intense. Yeah. Have any of you seen it at all?
I watched it this afternoon.
Me and Rich both did a rewatch today.
I haven't seen it in years, so I can't even remember. I don't even know if I'd like it if I saw it now. It was just like my emotional self.
The thing is, I've been slightly put off by I've never seen it either, and I Sanya slightly put me off it because the other film that she went on about to me for years after we met was City Slickers. If you know that film, so funny and so brilliant.
Yeah.
And eventually we settled down to watch it one night and we got about
half. Because this is, again, City Slickers was another film that I'd watched and loved, and I'd watched it more than once. Like, I've maybe seen City Slickers 3 times, which is a lot for me. And then hadn't seen it in maybe, I don't know, 12 years at that point, if not more. So I'd forgotten what happened in it.
Yeah, and then we got about half hour in, and then Sanja turns to me and goes, this isn't very good, is it?
It's the Doctor Who thing where you turn around and go, I'm so, so sorry.
It was a bit like that. I felt guilty. So hearing that you've watched Cinema Paradiso, and I'm like, I don't even know if I like it anymore because I haven't seen, I mean, I still like the music, so still, hands up, love the music. But I'm like, what if I don't even like it anymore?
I mean, I will confess, I opened up the WhatsApp chat when Jason said that, Sanya, you were choosing Cinema Paradiso, and I instantly thought of Guesthouse Paradiso.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Very different films entirely.
Oh, no.
So Sanya's got a weird cinema taste, but fair enough, to each their own, I guess. But
I would have been very surprised if it had been that.
I like what you're saying about how, and I think it's probably a good way of choosing your film, Sanya, because like, having that nostalgia and memories of this film from watching it so many times over when you were younger, because obviously, you know, obviously films like Terminator 2 for me is the same kind of thing where when I got hold of a copy and I used to just watch it constantly all the time.
And
obviously it helps that Terminator 2 is like a really good film, but I think even if it was a bad film, it would still be a good film to me because I'd have that connection through the memories of watching it all the time. So
I've got loads like that.
Terminator 2 is one of my top favorites as well. I've probably seen it more than 3 times, so that's, you know, that's like really high in my rankings.
Yeah, you do love Terminator 2.
Yeah, it's absolute classic.
Yeah.
You had to really
though, had you?
No, just Terminator 2.
I introduced you to Terminator.
I think what really stuck out to me about Cinema Paradiso, though, is for a film that was made in like 1988, set in the 40s and 50s, it still is really, really relevant. Like the kind of loss in like the human connection and like the loss of even like cinema are kind of coming more obsolete, like the loss of the picture house, the perils and pitfalls of nostalgia. It's like really relevant to today. I was like quite surprised.
So it's almost like you could look at the cinema as an analogue for your past self.
Yeah.
You're looking and watching your past self happen in the third person, and finally at the end, it comes down and it's like time to move on. It's that beautiful moment where it's like, wow. Yeah. I've never seen it. I've heard of it. It's been on, you're flicking through the TV at like 2 a.m. You know, flick for it. Then I watched the whole thing and I was like, this is shot sublimely. It's just fantastic where it chronicles this, like, is it nearly 40 years of this guy's life?
Yeah.
From the age of, 10 all the way till, must be, mid-50s at the end?
Yeah.
It's just, it's lovely. All the people that he comes into contact with, and it's just, everything changes gradually and modernises, and I just found it lovely. It was, again, it was a lovely study of the human condition, and you can be rich and high-flying as you like or as poor as you like. It's still the same universal story threads that go through everyone else's life. Like you said, unrequited love, missed opportunities.
Yeah.
So you've lost contact with physical things that you hold dear that you no longer have. And it's, and then families, and it's just, it's brilliant. I agree with you. Like, if that film stuck with me at a young age, and I watched it and I fell out of love with it, then that would be sad as well.
Yeah.
I can see why you haven't wanted to revisit it because of that attachment.
Yeah, it would bring up so many emotions at the time. It's like, it's a big investment. Like, if you're not in the mood for that. And then also, I think part of me is scared to watch it. What if I don't feel anything? What if I don't cry this time? Like, does that mean I'm dead inside? Yeah,
you don't want another City Slickers on your hands.
It definitely was a very funny cinema parody, so I didn't laugh much. So 6 out of 10.
I want to watch it now because you guys have sort of spoke so well.
No, it's so much pressure, though.
All right, next weekend. That's
but if you don't like it.
It's fine. Well, yeah, I'll just tell you this as well. We had this other thing. This is Sanya's other banging on about a film. Was Nightmare Before Christmas. Like, she went on about Nightmare. She'd never seen it.
I wanted to see it because I liked the artwork.
And we'd been to Disneyland and we'd been on the Haunted Mansion. They do a Halloween Christmas overlay of it on there, and you'd been on that. And, you know, I'm holding my hands up. I'm not a big Nightmare Before Christmas fan. I don't particularly enjoy it.
Suggesting it was like over the course of like 3 or 4 Halloweens, I kept saying, oh, shall we watch Nightmare Before Christmas? And you said no. And I wasn't dedicated enough to watch it on my own time. And then in the end, you gave in.
Yeah. And what did you think, Sanya? Yeah.
So
you're not. I know people love it.
Experience.
I know people love it, but I just find the music incredibly dreary.
It was tough. It was tough going.
So, but, you know, that's not to diss anyone who does love Nightmare Before Christmas. I know there are a lot of fans out there. It's just not for me. And I suspected it wouldn't be for Sanya either.
Yeah. The artwork's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, on a technical level, it's astonishing. But, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it.
Let's move on to your TV shows then, and Mr. Biffo, which TV show did you choose?
I couldn't choose one, so I'm going to cheat, but I will talk more about one than the other. The first one I had to pick, and it had a similar effect on me to Star Wars, and that is Doctor Who. And it made me fall in love with the making of TV. I mean, as much as I loved Doctor Who, I loved Doctor Who magazine, which, you know, it was the only magazine that where you had interviews with writers and, you know, the people that made the show. That was so rare when I was growing up, that you got that sort of behind-the-scenes access. So Doctor Who, I have a real love-hate-it thing going on because there's plenty of Doctor Who that I really don't enjoy. And yet, it's like I couldn't miss an episode, you know, even now, you know, as a kid growing up, I had to watch Doctor Who on a Saturday night, you know, or on a Tuesday or whenever they moved it to. And then, and it's still the same now, even though I haven't necessarily always loved modern Doctor Who, broad swathes of it I have. I can't miss an episode. It's just sort of, it would feel disloyal to the show as a whole if I ever didn't. But I think it just as a kid, it was, you know, the Britishness of it, yeah, because we would get, you know, ITV would have Buck Rogers and, you know, all those kind of American import shows, but Doctor Who was ours. It was sort of, you know, it was aliens on a high street or whatever, or in a British village, or, you know, it was, and that for me, it was the fact that it was happening in my home country that I think I connected to it. Because of that. Yeah, and a lot of Doctor Who is just a load of old crap. Watching some of those early episodes, they're just, it's just awful.
but
oh, do you mean story wise?
All of it, all of it, just all of it. I mean, and I'm saying this as someone who's picked Doctor Who as his favourite TV show. Yeah, there's so much Doctor Who that is terrible, and yet I have that nostalgic attachment to it that I can't separate that from. Well, I can, because I can quite easily go, that's just shit. But yeah, I'm not so close to it that I can't call it out as frequently being terrible. But yeah, it felt as well, the fact that they were trying to do so much with such small budgets, you know, in a corner of a studio, they'd create a jungle or, you know, a spaceship or whatever. You know, it was I always say this about video games as well, particularly sort of the old 8-bit games and, you know, the sort of ZX Spectrum era, how somehow the graphics for me were better back then because your imagination filled in the blanks. You know, you don't see the limitations, you know, particularly with pixel art and particularly, you know, the more, you know, they're all sorts of sort of games. There's one like Bugaboo the Flea on the Spectrum, I remember playing. Really basic graphics, but you're in a cave, you know, and you're this alien flea trying to jump out of a cave. But for me, that cave was real, you know, and it was stalagmites and, you know, dripping water and stuff. I filled in that black background, you know, with my own detail. I think Doctor Who was a bit like that.
Yeah, I think like with the games, I think a lot of the world building came from the actual artwork on the boxes as well. And I miss that. Like you said, like Mega Drive. Yeah, proper nice matte painting style, just hand-drawn. It just, it always made it look cinematic, and then it's just this bunch of pixels and squares and blobs.
You're immersed in it before you pop it in the machine.
Exactly.
Already your brain's accepting or expecting what it's going to be seeing, and then it automatically fills in that. And I agree with that. It totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I love Doctor Who on different levels and for different reasons, and it's not purely about the quality of the show, so... So yeah, so Doctor Who, and
before you move on, Biffo, I want to know which Doctor Who was your favourite or is?
Tom Baker was my Doctor growing up, but I've got a real soft spot for Matt Smith.
Man.
Yeah,
I just think he's such an inventive performer, and he was so perfectly cast as the Doctor. You know, funny but vulnerable. And old and young at the same time. And it was just the best casting. I mean, I know David Tennant's everyone's favourite because, oh, he's a bit cute and, you know, cheeky, chappy and charismatic and all the rest of it. But Matt Smith just had just the quirkiness and the sort of awkwardness, I think. Yeah, so he felt alien to me. David Tennant just feels like a bloke you go to the pub with. He's the 10th Doctor. You know, he just feels like your mate. And Matt Smith just feels a little bit odd as the Doctor, and that
makes him perfect for it.
Yeah.
So Matt's my Doctor. I've got him literally just behind my shoulder, actually.
He's mine too.
I've said it before, and I would always defend Matt Smith's camp, where everyone's just like, I do like him. I'm like, look, the guy is so natural, so effortless. All they've done is say, right, give Matt the script. And then it's like a cameraman just walked around with a Steadicam following him, just being himself. He is that natural. And he is that natural in interviews and performances. Watch him play Prince Philip in The Crown and watch him play the Doctor. They're two so quintessentially different characters. The way he flows with that performance is just perfection. He just does it so well.
Yeah.
I've not watched any of the new Game of Thrones prequel because I'm just not interested in the slightest, but from what I see, he's just doing well, and I'm glad for him that 10 years later he's breaking into the big game.
He's in Morpheus. You should watch that. I hear good things. So.
I've not seen it, actually.
No, I want to watch it because I've heard his
I don't think many other people saw it either, did they?
But I think the editor saw it. So,
yeah, I mean, I love Capaldi. I thought he was great. I don't think he was always best served with stories in his ear. It sort of felt to me like Moffat was a bit burnt out doing Sherlock at the same time. But I thought Capaldi, I liked his sort of grumpiness and his rudeness. I thought that was often good. I quite like Jodie Whittaker. I'm just not a fan of that era's storytelling. But Matt Smith just had the layers of complexity to his performance that I just thought was magic. Absolute magic.
Well, move on to your other TV pick.
Okay, so my other one is, again, I couldn't really choose between the two, so I just cheated and said two. And it's a show called Tim and Eric, Awesome Show, Great Job.
What a title. Yeah.
Tim and Eric, Eric Wertheim and Tim Heidecker. They started out on YouTube, or they started out film school making these weird little videos. And then they sent a CD-ROM, because that was the era, I think, to Bob Odenkirk, because they've been big fans of a show that Bob Odenkirk was in called Mr. Show, and said, when they sent it, they also included, I believe, an invoice to pay for the postage for what they'd sent him. And that got his attention. And he said, these guys are doing it. And he mentored them. And they then went to Adult Swim as a result of Bob Odenkirk's influence, and did a show called Tom Goes to the Mayor, which is a very weird show, which is kind of not quite animation. It's just scenes of Tim and Eric, but kind of photocopied cutout figures. And they do voiceover on these scenes. It's very odd. But then they did this show called Awesome Show, Great Job. And I don't know how old I was when I first saw it, because it's a relatively new show, as in 15 years ago, something like that. But I sort of felt, I'm at the age now where I've kind of, I sort of know everything I like, and it's very hard to be impressed and very hard to kind of go, I'm influenced by a new thing. You know, it's like they sort of say your music taste kind of freeze at 14 or something like that. And I thought it was the same with comedy. In even kind of the comedy that I love, like, you know, Vic and Bob, for instance, I never sort of said, they're an influence on me, because it more felt like, they've just got the same sense of humour as me. You know, Python was a big influence. The Young Ones was a big influence. But then I was, sort of 35 or something like that, and saw Tim and Eric, Awesome Show, Great Job, and just went, this is just a whole new sort of vocabulary of comedy and how to do jokes. And by using the editing as a sort of comedic tool. And I'd never seen anything like it. And, you know, people may not realize it, because their show very much remained a cult thing on Adult Swim. But it the influence it's had is insane since that show came out. And it's not just them. It's like people like, there's a guy called Doug Pound, not his real name, who was their editor. And there's, you know, these guys, they would basically just set up the camera, film this stuff, and then give it to their editors, who would just edit in all these weird pauses or kind of just weird, I don't know, sort of jump cuts that. It's just, it's sort of just next level bizarre. The editing is just wrong. Everything's wrong about the editing. And yet it's so, in my book, so funny, and it's surreal, and just, I don't know. It was just lovely at what I thought, you know, now 35 or 36 or whatever feels young. But when I saw it, it was like, oh yeah, at my age, it's nice to find something new that I'm really impressed by, but just like really new. You know, when it came out, it just felt like there's never been anything like this before, ever. So yeah, Tim and Eric, Awesome Show, Great Job. Huge influence on me, and I don't mind admitting it.
I watched a little bit on YouTube of it, and I'm very intrigued. I think I would like to catch a few more episodes of it, because it does look really funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all comedy, it's hit and miss, and it's subjective, and it's certainly not for everyone's cup of tea. Yeah.
Did they call it anti-comedy?
Well,
he does. Tim Heidecker does not like.
He hates anti comedy.
Being called anti comedy, but a lot of people do call it that.
Where often there's no punchline, there's no jokes, there's no nothing like that. It's just weird.
And it's Marmite. Like, some people really don't like it because they're like, what's funny about this? But that's what makes it funny to the other people who do like it.
But that was sort of what we were doing on Teletext back in the day, you know, on Digitizer, weird do stuff that we knew had no point and wasn't a joke. And it would annoy people, and it would annoy the sub editors, and that made us laugh. Right. You know, people not getting it, we found funny, which is just, I know that's messed up, but there would be enough people that would get, this isn't funny. And because it's not funny, people will get funny. Annoyed.
Yeah.
And they got that as well.
Yeah. So did it feel like Tim and Eric were kind of like kindred spirits to you when you saw their work?
Again, a bit like Vic and Bob, it was like, that's my sense of humor. But
right.
It was what influenced me was their editing.
Right.
What I cite as an influence was just the way they edited their stuff together with... It was this sort of kind of lo-fi sort of cable TV influence they had in America that felt sort of VHS-y. And when I was doing for YouTube Mr. Biffo's found footage, it just felt like, oh, that's a really good delivery method, you know, for how I tell jokes and the kind of humour that I do. It felt like that lo-fi aesthetic works. Partly because I think I was trying to tap into, oh, teletext is this shit, archaic medium that, you know, is sort of really old-fashioned and out of date. And so I was trying to find something that felt like that.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't mind admitting that the editing on found footage was very influenced by them. There you go. I've outed myself.
Okay, well, let's move on to Sanya, TV chick.
Yeah.
What was that? TV
chick. The TV chick, Sanya Rose. This is the 70s now.
Back in Australia. Oh, I think it's really hard as well because it's like there are so many good shows on. It's how do you choose? Like literally at the moment, it's at the moment there's like a ton of shows that we love.
TV.
Yeah, it is. So it's really hard to pick. So again, I had to choose through which one have I watched more than once, and I picked Stathlet's Flats because I've watched I can't remember, are they two or three series?
Three or four now, aren't they?
Because I just kind of binged them all in one go, one after the other, three times, which is a lot for me. And I just love it. It just makes me laugh so much.
Do you want to explain what Stathlet's Flats is?
Stathlet's Flats is set in a letting agency, and it's a sitcom. And it's like just kind of what they do. I don't know.
It's a Channel 4 sitcom. Are they Greek Cypriots? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. Jamie Dimitriou.
Yeah.
His sister Natasha Dimitriou is in What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No. You can explain.
Just giving some context.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So it's. They run this, well, their dad owns the lettings agency and they're trying to run it for him. And it's just like their adventures. I don't know. Not really adventures.
The main guy, Stath, is just a massive idiot.
Yeah. This is relating back to what we were talking about, Star Wars and Andor and stuff. It's very kind of grounded in reality. They're not like cool, slick people, but they're not like, okay, they are a little bit unbelievable, but they're close enough to reality that you can relate to them and kind of go, oh, I know someone a bit like that, especially the other characters. So maybe Jamie's a bit exaggerated. His sister's a bit staff. That's it. He's a bit exaggerated and his sister's character's quite exaggerated. But the others who worked in the letting agency are just normal people. Yeah, you know, he stutters and his sister makes up ridiculous songs that you kind of go, oh my god. But I just love it and made me laugh so much. So I first watched it with Paul and then watched it again and then had to share it with one of my kids because I knew she'd love it. And I just think it's just like uplifting and funny and
it's nice, isn't it? Because they're all sort of nice people.
Yeah, they're all likeable.
Just useless.
Yeah.
For me, sorry to jump in, but because I love Stathless Flats as well. For me, it's the central performance is Stath, the character of Stath. When I was growing up, I loved Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, which has not aged well. The physical performance is amazing. And for me, Stathless Flats is almost a sort of spiritual successor to it because it's his physical sort of awkwardness that's funny.
Yeah, he's so awkward. Oh my goodness. But then there's all these twists in the story that you kind of go, what? I didn't see that coming. And it's, yeah, I just love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But saying that, it was hard to choose because there are so many shows. It's like, I can't choose.
That's the problem these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's just too much.
Yeah. Yeah, because like if we're talking like right now in this moment, it's Andor is number one.
Same.
I did look at YouTube for a little bit. I can see what you mean by him getting himself into like these embarrassing predicaments and stuff. And he does like to sing, doesn't he?
Badly.
Oh, Oh my god! But it's the sister and one of their colleagues. They make up little songs that are just, I don't know, they hit my funny bone.
There's a bit I stole from Statlet's Flats for Beanus.
Is there?
Yeah, you remember in the Christmas episode, the Beanus episode, where he's pinching everyone?
Oh, right.
There's this bit, because it made me laugh till I hurt, in Statlet's Flats, where he's showing a couple around a house, or is about to, and the woman's pregnant. And just out of the blue, he kind of pinches. You go, pinch for the baby, pinches her belly. It's like so wrong. Because he's just awkward and doesn't know how to interact with people.
That's such a Beanus thing to do.
Pinch for the baby. No. You just see them like flinch away from him. Anyway,
yeah,
that's all. Pinching's funny.
But I mean, this year alone has had so many good shows. Was another really great show that I really, really loved was Moon Knight.
Oh yeah,
I thought that was absolutely phenomenal in what it looked like. Number one, and the storyline was just for me, it was original. I hadn't seen anything like it before. Yeah,
we're watching Handmaid's Tale at the moment.
Handmaid's Tale. Oh, I know, but I hesitate to say that as a favorite because it's so grim. It's like really depressing, but it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant again. Yeah.
What's that on? Is that on Netflix?
It's.
Oh my goodness. That's a whole. This is a whole issue.
New stories currently on Amazon Prime or the new series, but it's one episode a week, which we're annoyed by.
Yeah. We've been desperately trying to find other ways to watch it.
Not illegal.
To see if it's on anywhere else. One episode a week.
Yeah, you can't do it anymore, can you? I mean, that was just the norm back in the day, wasn't it? But now you just like, if they don't drop it all at once, you're like, what?
Yeah, what madness is this?
Yeah, exactly. It's like when Stranger Things came out, it's like, what? You're dropping it every week?
Yeah.
Really? You can't do this to us, surely. I'm ready to binge watch this now. Yeah. But...
we're not used to this.
We have to have
patience. Yeah.
Come on, we have a short attention span these days. We need it. We need it now.
Come on.
Get into your video game picks then, and Mr. Biffo, you've chosen an all-time classic, I believe.
Yeah, not an original one, but Half-Life 2, which is the only game I've probably completed more than twice. I mean, I've lost count of how many times I've played through it. It's just a comfort game. I mean, when it came out, it was gobsmacking, just the physics and the how this is clearly something with me that, you know, is why I love Star Wars as well. Just how real that world felt and how run down it felt. And that coupled to being able to interact with that world in a, you know, in a way that felt realistic. And it was such a playground of a game when it first came out, because, you know, when you got that gravity gun with people, you know, and spend ages just picking things up with it and just stacking things on top of each other and just firing things across the, you know, across the street. And it was just amazing. And I mean, I loved the original Half-Life, but then also you had what they did brilliantly with the second one was just giving you Alex as a companion, and her and Dog, you know, gave the game personality, which was no mean feat for a game with a central character who never spoke. And you never saw his face, and they found a way to humanize it and make you care. And it just works on so many levels. It's such a clever, clever game. And so few games since have achieved that and made me care as much about what's going on in it. I mean, I nearly chose The Last of Us because that is the only game I've ever really had an attachment to the characters. I mean, there's a bit in that spoiler where one of the main characters falls off a balcony and gets impaled on a bit of metal rebar. And I genuinely cried out, no, when it happened. And it took me by surprise because it was like, yeah, I'm really emotionally invested in this, you know, but Half-Life 2, I'm in that world, you know, they're talking to me. You know, I can respond if I want, you know, no one's scripted my dialogue. But even things in that is just, we don't go to Ravenholm. There's a level, creepy sort of town where there's headcrab zombie guys wandering around, and that level you know that's the first one where you can pick up pots of paint and fire them at the zombies, and the paint splashes all over the zombies because the lid of the pots come off, and that is just like, this is just insane. Who thought of that detail? You know, you can't, it's not just you're firing stuff at them, they're now getting covered in paint. It's just I don't know, I mean, I could talk about the level of details, things like, you know, when dropships fly overhead and the sort of wires on the telegraph poles all shake because of the downblast of the engines, and then things like in some of the the city when you're in the apartments and the doors, they don't just have kind of frosted glass or just regular glass in them, you know, they've got this sort of textured glass and it distorts what's behind them, you know. It's such a technically clever game. And yeah, just brilliant, just absolutely brilliant. And you know, I haven't got the VR headset at the moment, but you know, if anything was going to make me get one, not the one that will play Half-Life Alyx. Oh. But if anything was going to make me get a really expensive, you know, VR headset, it would be Half-Life Alyx, because the fact that there's never been a Half-Life 3 is just criminal. But you know, I can also understand them going, we're never going to be able to sort of live up to the legend.
How long ago did Half-Life 2 come out?
Jeez, what was it, 2004,
I think?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So nothing since then has...
Apart from this one VR game that came out last year or year before, something like that. Yeah.
I mean, for you, nothing has topped Half-Life 2.
Nothing that I... The Last of Us has come close. Right. The Last of... I mean, I'm not a big multiplayer game fan. I like games where I feel I'm alone on an adventure. You know, I like a story. I like a journey. I like a sense of exploration. And that's really what Half-Life 2 does as well so brilliantly. It's a real journey you go on. So, you know, it's very linear, but it's games since, yeah, they've all fallen into this open world trap where, you know, you can go anywhere and do it. And, you know, I like that to a point. But having that sort of linear focus that Half-Life 2 had, while also sort of somehow hinting at a world beyond it, I just don't think there's been anything quite like it since. As I say, Last of Us and Last of Us 2 come close, but you know, they don't feel quite as free as Half-Life 2 did, in the, because that had that, you know, see, I'm going to shut up in a second, I promise. But like the bit where you're like driving the buggy kind of across through the abandoned highways and you go, oh, there's a house and I'll just stop and I'll go and explore that house, you know.
And then the house inside is got all the details.
Yeah. And there'll be like a swing outside the house and it's like, oh, I'll play with that swing, and just because you can play with all the building
objects.
Oh,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's just like really interactive.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was quite a big thing back then as well, wasn't it? Because we've never really been able to kind of have that kind of interaction before, especially like we say with the gravity gun and being able to do all that kind of stuff and go, oh, I wonder what would happen if I did this with the gun and that. And they kind of thought about it and you saw the reactions to it. And
yeah.
That just made that game just that little bit more special.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
And you kind of brushed on like why Valve haven't done Half-Life 3. But do you not think that the way video game world has changed dramatically since Half-Life 2 to where we are now, do you not think that maybe they could do something better than Half-Life 2 in the way that game development has gone now?
I mean, there's a lot of things I think that potentially are a risk, because commercially everything has moved much more into that multiplayer you know, microtransaction world and releasing. You know, Half-Life 2 was always, and Half-Life, you know, they were a single player experience, like, right? You had, you know, kind of Team Fortress spin-off and, yeah, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, to release a game that is primarily single player is always a risk. All right, yeah, I know you've got the Half-Life brand attached to it, which, you know, would give it a huge boost. But I think what, you know, let's gloss over the fact that, you know, Valve are quite happy just to, you know, make all their money on Steam. You know, that's really what's going on, probably, I think. But also, just, you can't imagine, I suppose, the pressure of releasing a game that has as big an impact as Half-Life 2 did at the time. You know, Half-Life 2 changed everything, but also nothing ever really lived up to it. You know, the introduction of sort of physics into games, I mean, now they're sort of second nature. You know, what, you know, but that gravity gun and the, on top of that, sort of the Alex and the dog interactions and everything else, you know, without, unless they can come up with a conceit that sort of a gameplay conceit that is as much of a game changer, excuse the pun, as the gravity gun was, I think they're going to end up getting, you know, I don't know, crucified. I tell you what did nearly come close to it, or made me feel like, oh, this is almost a Half-Life 2 successor, was Titanfall 2. Really clever, a really, really clever single player storyline, which used time travel in a similar sort of way to the gravity gun, not in the same way, but in the same way that, oh, this is a, they've really thought about the gameplay mechanics here, in that, you know, you could, let's say, I mean, it's been a few years since I played it, but let's say, you know, you're trying to cross a bridge and the bridge has collapsed. Oh, okay, I can just jump back in time quickly to that era when the bridge was still intact and walk across and then jump back. And it did stuff like that really smartly while also having a really engaging story. So Titanfall 2 was really good, but again, not quite revolutionary enough to be a Half-Life 2 beta, and also just people overlooked it because they wanted multiplayer. Yeah, you know, that was the aspect that people were interested in with those games. So I think there's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of obstacles in its path, I think. But the biggest one probably is just Steam. You know, they just want to, you know, that's making so much money. Why bother with game development? You know, why bother with Portal 3 even? I mean, Portal, yeah, the Portal games, you know, were clearly... Yeah. I'm guessing, I don't know, this is completely a guess, that the portal gun was perhaps intended at one point for Half-Life 3 or something like that. I don't know. You know, and then they built an entire game around it. You know, Portal 2 is very much, you know, it has a story. It has, you know, you've got the Stephen Merchant robot who chats to you throughout, that, you know, it all feels very Half-Life-y. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'd love one just because I'd love to go back to that world again. But, you know, short of buying, you know, £3,000 worth of kit, it's not going to happen.
When you replay the game, do you get a completely different experience? No, is it?
Not really. I might play with the gravity gun in a different way, but
right.
It just feels so tactile, this game. That's what it had. It was tactile because of the way you interacted with the world.
It's a shame with Steam and how much money they do actually make, because Valve do make great games. And I think there's a ton of people out there who are just clamoring for Half-Life 3 or even a Portal 3, myself included, because Portal 2 is like one of my favourite games ever.
Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, they just do like a Konami at this point and just basically source the IPs out to developers. I'm sure someone would love to make Half-Life game for Valve. Sure. You know?
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe one day we'll get it. Maybe one day.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to Sanya's video game pick. And
why are you laughing?
What did you choose? Don't worry, Sanya, because during lockdown, I sank 250 hours into this game. So
yeah, me and my wife had fights over it, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You? Oh, yay. Yeah.
I had to buy her a Switch because we were probably going to get divorced, so.
No, oh my god, I love that. Wow. Okay, so it's Animal Crossing.
Well, the new one.
The new one. I'll just preface this by saying I don't usually play games. I always thought video games stressed me out a lot because, like, you know, they get your adrenaline spiking and they get those cortisol levels rising. So I always thought games are too stressful for me. And then I came across this video once on YouTube where this girl was saying there's this whole genre called cozy games and they don't stress you out. They're just like, you're just like living life, doing the tasks in the game, going on adventures, exploring. And that really piqued my curiosity. And one of the games she mentioned was Animal Crossing. I mean, I did first start with, you had a short hike on your Switch, didn't you?
Yeah. Highly recommended.
Highly That's recommended.
Yeah. That, great game.
Because I talked to Paul about cozy games and he said, oh, yeah, well, there's this game on the Switch already called A Short Hike. Have a go at that and see what you think. And my God, I mean, the whole weekend was gone on this game. It is like a really short game. But I was so into it and did find it very relaxing and fun. And it's just great. You just get to explore and walk up a mountain and learn to fly and go on little missions and stuff. So when after I'd finished that, I was like, oh, I wonder what else there is, and saw that Animal Crossing was already on the Switch. So it was like, okay. I mean, I had played it.
My Switch.
On your, yeah, Paul.
Switch. I am a Switch widower.
Yeah, I played Animal Crossing like years ago and loved it. But that was like, what, 10 years ago, something like that. So I thought, okay, let's see if it's still good. And I've gotten so addicted to it. But it's also like, it just, every time I think, okay, maybe I'm getting to the end of my interest. There's not much else happening. Something new comes along, like, oh, you can grow wheat now and cook food. Oh, you can wear a wetsuit and go into the ocean. And it's like, what on earth? The amount of detail that is in this game. It's like, how long did it take them to create this? Like 5,000 years? There's like 4 million people working on it. Like, I'm just amazed at the attention to detail in it. And it's just so much fun and it's so relaxing.
I don't see the point of it. I've tried.
Yeah.
I can't handle it. Why it was on there was because I bought it, because it was like everyone was banging on about it in lockdown. Yeah. And, you know, the whole world seemingly loved it. But I just can't get on with games like that. Stardew Valley's another one that I've tried.
I love Stardew Valley. About 400 hours on that game.
And it just feels like work.
Oh, I love it.
I have enough of this during the day doing stuff.
I know, but you're in another world. I mean, first of all, like, how easy is it to make money in the game? Like, I wish it was like that in real life. I'm just going to go pick some oranges and sell them.
It's to just, two raccoons.
yeah, exactly. It's so perfect for, I was going through a period where I wanted to relax in the evening, but my brain couldn't handle reading. And it was just like, I just want something I can lose myself in, but not have to think too much. And it's perfect. Like, yeah, just go and pluck some weeds. Go and like talk to some neighbors and give them a gift to try and manipulate them into liking you. It's great.
No, that's like real life, and I don't want my neighbors to like me.
Oh, yeah, but when they come into your house and then won't leave, and then it's like, and then I found myself Googling, like, what do you do when a neighbor won't leave? And like all these kind of things. And it's like, whoa, I'm really invested in this game.
Like Mr. Biffo said, I bought it and downloaded it out of the interest because it was getting so much coverage on the internet and everything. And I'm not one for these kind of games. I don't like farming sims that much or Stardew. I find them boring. Yeah. I just don't find the appeal in having to farm a load of crops, wait for them to grow, and then, you know, farm them and feed the cows and all this kind of stuff. But
yeah,
as soon as I fired up Animal Crossing, I don't know, there's just something about that game that just clicked, and I was just in. I was invested straight away, and I just didn't put it down until I was completely happy with my island. And even then, I was finding things that I still didn't like, and I was still like landscaping it, building cliffs, fountains, and this, that, and the other. And you know, my wife,
yeah.
Wow.
You do like terraforming so you can create like moats and valleys and mountains and hills and you name it. So
you should see Sanya's face right now, by the way.
Lose 100 more hours in this now.
They say Animal Crossing's not stressful though, but it's, I mean, it's genuinely, it's got the most terrifying spiders in any game. Like, like worse than a Resident Evil, the way they rear up and chase you, like genuine anxiety attacks. And just like...
I haven't seen the tarantulas yet. Oh, I think they're not in season at the moment. But I have experienced the scorpions.
Yeah, they're not funny either, but tarantulas are next level, just uncomfortable.
My wife was going, should we go and watch a film? And going, yep, okay, let's go and watch a film. And then I take my Switch with me and then I'm terraforming and doing this and doing that and putting lamps here and decorations there while we're watching the film. Yeah, just completely in on it.
Yeah, I've never played it. All my nieces have. And I'm one of those people that Jason was like, I have never played a farm sim. You see, you got Farmville and Heyday and everything like that, that everyone I know is like, oh, play this, play that. And I'm like, no, no, no. The closest I got was, do you remember the Jurassic Park builder that came out like 10 years ago?
Yeah.
I spent hours building my park and Eve, you know, making sure dinosaurs evolved properly. And that's the last thing, like farming sim-wise, I've ever actually touched.
Like you played it so much you didn't want to play anything like that again, or
I think maybe because it's the connection to Jurassic Park, because it was essentially just a farming sim where you buy, sell, and grow crops, feed the dinosaurs, grow the dinosaurs, and earn money from them.
Yeah,
kind of fundamentally the same. I just never got around to getting into the whole Animal Crossing thing. I've only had a Switch for not even a year, so I was quite late to the Switch as well. So
I think I get really excited at like you school management. You know, more really open-ended games, and then when I play them, I almost get a level of overwhelm, and I don't know what to do. So now I go back to really, really like linear stuff. I think that's just what I prefer. It's always the idea always sounds nice, but when I'm actually sat down with it, I'm like, I don't know what to do first. I don't know what's more important, so I just think, oh, I turn off and I go play something really, really, really handholdy and linear, and I know what I need to do. It's mission orientated, and that's it.
The end of your picks, and a great bunch of picks actually, and highlighted some programs and films that I'm really intrigued and would like to go back and give a watch at some time. So thank you for those picks. That was awesome stuff. And also thank you for your time to come on and talk about them and just hang out on our little podcast. So
it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah, it was good fun. Really enjoyed it.
And this is your time to plug away. Please let people listening about everything that you're doing, where your YouTube channel is. Not Kickstarter anymore, but you know, Digitizer TV series 2, the hopefully live event next year, maybe, or anything else that's going on.
Yeah. Well, our main hub is YouTube, so just look for Digitizer on there, and we've hopefully early-ish next year got Digi Level 2 coming out, which is a sort of second series of Digitizer the Show that we did. And then, because it's Digitizer's 30th anniversary, believe it or not, next year, I am that old. So we're going to try and celebrate it. And so we're hopefully going to have a live event, which might be 2 days, because there's been people have sort of said, oh, they'd like it to last a bit longer. So, but people be able to get day tickets and just kind of one of the events, but you know, as it's the 30th anniversary, we thought, well, let's make a weekend of it and see what we can do. But we've got all this. I'm hesitating slightly just because some of this we haven't put into motion, but we've got lots of intentions.
The YouTube channel is there
with regular, pretty much weekly videos of us doing whatever, really. We don't even know what the channel is. I mean, you know, we started out talking about video games. Now we just do any old shit, really. Just put silly characters and silly things. That's it. And it's me and Sanya primarily, and we have guests on from time to time, but it's mainly the two of us now, because it was during lockdown, realised, oh, I have a co-host who lives with me, or potential co-host who lives with me, so I don't have to just shout into the void. And she's stuck. Well, we do a podcast, but no one's going to be interested in that because it's about Marillion. It's very niche, but it's also more of the two of us arguing with one another, basically, for like an hour. It's mainly that.
One thing that I did want to mention to you while you were here that you can plug as well is the music that you make on Bandcamp.
Oh, lovely. I tend to forget about that.
Yeah.
I go to my Bandcamp, Mr. Biffo. Well, it's not Mr. Biffo. Anything. It's Bandcamp. Look for Mr. Biffo on there. I just got into it a couple of years ago. It's a hobby, really, which is why I don't think to plug it. It's just purely me entertaining myself. I don't know if I'm any good at it, but, you know, the few people seem to like it. I sold another copy of the album yesterday.
I saw.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, you saw. Checking up on me, huh? So, yes, I can plug that. Go listen to some funny, it's not really funny, some sort of instrumentally music. Proggy, electronic-y, atmospheric-y, cinematic-y type thing, but by an enthusiastic amateur who probably should stay in his lane. I think that's what people think. I shouldn't have put it out under Mr. Biffo. I should have given myself a different name.
No, it's good. It's good to have. I think it's good to have that connection because people will know where it's come from. Yeah, I guess, you know.
I think so. It's a funny thing because it's like when I was watching Jules Holland. Later with Jules Holland yesterday, and then Tom Hanks' wife popped up on it because she's got a single out, an album out, or something. What's her name? Rita Wilson, is that her name? I can't remember.
Yes, I believe so.
An actor as well. And my gut reaction was, what's she doing on here? You know, she shouldn't be on it. She's not a musician. So I totally get it. and then I felt bad. It's like, I'm doing exactly the same. Stay in your lane, Paul. Stay in your lane. Anyway, I do it because I enjoy it. That's the main thing.
It's nice music actually just to have in the background while you're working.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's what it's for, really. It's instrumental and just, you know, atmosphere.
Yeah, I listen to podcasts or music all day at work because I work on my own mostly, and so it's nice to have a bunch of music like that just so you can have it on through the earpods. In the background, just to
thank you. Yeah. I'm glad you like it. Oh, yeah, that means because I still don't feel like I know what I'm doing. So it's trial and error. I'm really picking it up, aren't I?
Sometimes that's the best way, though, isn't it? So
I like it.
Thank you, dear. All one times that you've listened to.
No, I've listened to it more than
twice.
Once.
Twice. Laughing nervously. Anyway.
Okay, well, that's your lot for this one. Thank you, as always, to everyone for joining us. And if you've enjoyed the podcast and would like to support us, we do have a Ko-fi page where you can give us a one-off tip, or if you're feeling kinder, a monthly tip starting from £1. A massive thank you to all who have done so. You're all legends. And if that is not right for you right now, you can also support us by giving us a review or rating on Apple or Spotify. You can find the links in the show description. Please go and check out our website where you can find links to our Ko-fi page, our entire back catalogue of episodes, written articles and much more. You can find the website at thewolfiepod.com. And don't forget the Twitter competition I mentioned at the beginning of the show. Please keep an eye out at thewolfiepod on Twitter. Next time we hit the last year in our timeline. Yep, we have reached the movies of 1999. Please look out for that in a couple of weeks' time. You've been listening to the 50th episode of What's Wrong With Wolfie. Dom, it's over to you.
Well, that's it for another episode of What's Wrong with Wolfie. The boys are off now to hit the roulette table with Patricia Routledge. See you later.
What's wrong with Wolfie? I can hear him barking.